The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Dr. Duncan Webb.
Tēnā koe, te mana whakawā. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What do the latest reports on New Zealand's GDP show about the strength of the New Zealand economy? And how does this support the response to the Delta COVID outbreak?
Mr. Speaker, Statistics New Zealand reported last week that GDP rose by 2.8% for the June 2021 quarter, the strongest quarterly growth since 1999, with the exception of the one-off bounce back in September 20, and a significantly better result than even the most optimistic commentators had forecast. The economy in the June 2021 quarter was 4.3% above where it was in the pre-COVID December 2019 quarter. Mr. Speaker, what this gives us room for is our quick and decisive response to the current outbreak, including providing cash flow and confidence through schemes such as the wage subsidy, which also in turn help the economy to rebound quickly again. We do know, however, that the impact of this outbreak has been uneven, and we're continuing to work with affected sectors to support them in these challenging times.
Supplementary. How widespread was the growth in the June quarter?
Mr. Speaker, the expansion was broad-based as our approach meant households and businesses had the confidence to move about and operate more freely than in many other countries during this period. The primary sector grew 5% in the June quarter compared with the March quarter, led by fishing and agriculture. The goods-producing industry was up by 1.3%, with solid activity in construction and manufacturing. The services sector, which makes up two-thirds of the economy, expanded by 2.8% in the quarter, with retail, accommodation and restaurants benefiting from New Zealanders spending more time at the shops, eating out and on holiday. Business confidence in the economy was also reflected in investment levels, which remained high and above pre-COVID levels. The ANZ noted that this broad momentum is what we want to see to be confident that the economy can keep going. Nevertheless, we know that some sectors and regions are doing it tough, and we continue to monitor and assess that situation.
How is this growth in the economy supporting the response to the current Delta COVID-19 outbreak?
Mr. Speaker, economic growth has been reflected in the government's books, which shows that revenue is well ahead of forecasts, along with lower deficits and debt than had been forecast. This gives the government greater fiscal headroom to combat the outbreak, which we have done by topping up the COVID-19 Response and Recovery Fund by an extra $7 billion. There is also an additional $3 billion available to spend from money previously allocated in the fund that had not been spent. We have already boosted support to business in this lockdown, and the extra funding will be targeted at further economic support, as well as building further resilience in our health system and supporting initiatives such as the vaccination rollout and border and MIQ provision.
Question number two, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister, does she stand by all of her government's statements and actions?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, yes, including our announcement yesterday that Auckland will move to level 3 from 11:59pm tonight. This decision was based on advice from the Director General of Health and was made because level 3 is an extension of the strict social distancing protocols that will help keep New Zealanders safe and, of course, continues to ask Aucklanders to stay in their bubbles and reduce interaction with others as much as possible. By moving Auckland in this way, we're ensuring we protect against the spread. And Mr. Speaker, Auckland will be in level 3 for at least 2 weeks because the Director General was clear that given the long, hard tail of Delta, we will need time here. But this move gives Aucklanders greater certainty as we continue our work to combat COVID-19.
Is the government still committed to eliminating COVID-19 from the community?
Mr. Speaker, as the member will have heard me say yesterday, we continue to take a zero tolerance approach to COVID-19, and that means stamping out, as we've said consistently, all the way since the very beginning, stamping out cases whenever we see them arise. That has not changed, and we continue to commit to that yesterday.
How many more times is she prepared to put Auckland or other parts of New Zealand into a level 4 lockdown in order to continue with her strategy?
Mr. Speaker, as I've said time and time again, lockdowns have been used because we haven't had other tools available, including, for instance, as has been noted by almost every country that has used lockdowns, and they've been a strategy around the world, until the ability to treat COVID or indeed vaccinate against COVID. We now have vaccinations available, and we are working incredibly hard to ensure that everyone who is eligible is vaccinated. Fantastic to see how close Auckland is to reaching 80% of eligible Aucklanders having received their first dose. We have the capability to, within another 2 weeks beyond that, reach 90%, but it is incumbent upon all of us to work with all of our communities to ensure that people who may have concerns have those concerns addressed and are vaccinated, because it is the best way to remove the need to use those harshest public health restrictions.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Has the Prime Minister seen suggestions that the New Zealand government should have set a vaccination target of around 70%? And is she satisfied that, based on first doses, we've already well and truly exceeded that?
Mr Speaker, yes, I actually have seen various members of the National Party. The member asking the questions, I think, has suggested something like 70%. I've seen Chris Bishop suggest something closer to 80%. Dr Retty, more around the 90% mark. The point that I would make, we need as many people as possible to be vaccinated. You will have heard Dr Bloomfield say 90+. And the reason
Order.
That you'll hear us talking about such high rates is the higher you go, the fewer ongoing restrictions that are required on a day-to-day basis to ensure people's safety. And perhaps, Mr Bishop, perhaps that's something we all agree on.
So if vaccinations are critical to preventing level 4 lockdowns, then why were only 20% of eligible New Zealanders fully vaccinated against COVID at the start of the Delta outbreak?
Mr Speaker, vaccinations are critical for us not having to use them in the future, but you can see that even countries who have had months of availability of vaccination, they have in some cases had low uptake. My hope for New Zealand is we won't be one of those countries. We're in shooting distance of passing, for instance, the United States vaccination levels in the coming days, I believe. So that's a demonstration that despite having had a country that for a long period of time has had availability, it all comes down to your ability to work alongside your communities and ensure good take-up rates. That is something surely this House can work collaboratively on.
Then again, why were only 20% of eligible New Zealanders fully vaccinated at the start of this latest Delta outbreak?
Mr Speaker, I note the member is referring to fully vaccinated rates. Mr Speaker, the member well knows that we, at that time, were using all of the supply available to us, but we did not have enough supply from Pfizer to enable a greater rate of vaccine at that time. That is no longer the case. We long signalled from the beginning of the year that the arrival of our largest orders of doses would be in the latter half of 2021. That is totally incorrect.
I just want to make it clear to Mr Bishop, he may not be aware that his leader's mic is open, and his very loud interjections, very frequent interjections, his interjections that are sometimes repetitive and therefore on all bases out of order, are interfering with people's ability to hear the answers, including mine. I rely on the microphone systems within here to do it, and when the Prime Minister is being drowned out by him because he is using his leader's microphone, then it means that people outside the buildings had trouble hearing as well.
Point of order.
A point of order, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Mr Speaker, putting aside any difference of view I might have on the degree to which Mr Bishop's interventions were rare and reasonable, if there is a problem with the sound system, that is a problem the House has, not Mr Bishop. And what we're hearing is that those interjections, rare and reasonable, are being moderated because of a failure in the sound system. And I think that's something that needs to be looked at.
No, I just want to make it absolutely clear from when I was first an MP here, and in fact earlier on when there were overhead microphones hanging down, some of them were turned on and off in order for a particular individual to get the call. That's what the staff do. The leader of the opposition's microphone is not turned off in between her primary question and her supplementary or other supplementary questions. We can do that if the member wants. If that is the member's request, we can move to a system whereby his leader's microphone is turned off and then turned on again. But that has not been the practice in the House. And what has occurred is that members who sit around, people who are asking questions, have always given some respect to the person who is asking the question by not using the microphone. Had the Prime Minister finished?
Yes.
Further supplementary.
To the Prime Minister, what advice has she had on the economic cost of 5 weeks of level four lockdown on Auckland?
Mr. Speaker, and perhaps I can assist with the microphone issue by no longer continuing to answer Mr. Bishop's questions rather than the Leader of the Opposition's questions. Mr. Speaker, I have
order,
in my mind...
Order. Prime Minister, resume the seat. I'm sorry. It's not appropriate for the Prime Minister or any other member to comment on the rulings that I have made. Continue.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, my recollection of the last advice we received from Treasury was that for the extension that we last had in Auckland, that amounted to a $700 million cost. There is no question that there is, of course, a cost to the economy and indeed people's lives through restrictions. However, we have to, of course, factor in the costs of widespread uncontrolled outbreaks and the impact that that has on people's lives and livelihoods also.
So is that per week or is that over the five-week stretch where people have been locked down for in a level four lockdown?
Mr. Speaker, as I just said, that was for the one-week extension. I'm sure the member can extrapolate across the 5 weeks, keeping in mind we have had different parts of the country at different alert levels, and therefore the drawdown on, for instance, the wage subsidy and the resurgence payment varies. If the member would like me to bring the precise figures for each of those weeks, I can do that happily to do so if she pops that one on notice.
So why did she wait until a Delta outbreak to buy additional vaccines from other countries?
Mr. Speaker, I completely reject the assertion in that member's question, as I do the statement made by the member behind her, who in the course of her asking her questions, and the member may wish to take issue with the fact that he has done this over the top of her, gave the assertion that in some way that we have delayed the delivery of vaccines to New Zealand. I find that an outrageous claim. At every step, we have sought to access the Pfizer vaccine as quickly as we were able. In fact, entering into arrangements with Pfizer before the completion of clinical trials. The fact of the matter is, though, Mr. Speaker, most countries have not received their vaccines at a time that is convenient to them, but rather at the time they're being available from manufacturers. As they have arrived, we have distributed. To answer the member's question on the outbreak, as soon as we had that outbreak, there was a huge surge in demand, and rather than curtailing that demand to meet the supply that we had, we met it and pulled out all the stops to then try and supplement that supply through other countries who may have had availability to support that. And we were able to do so, and I stand by that work.
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Can the Prime Minister confirm that the market for vaccines, much like every other market, relies on there being a willing buyer and a willing seller, and it is only in recent weeks that there have been other countries being willing to sell?
Mr. Speaker, that is absolutely right. You will, of course, other countries have sought to purchase vaccines to cover their entire populations and in some cases have found that with the reasonably short shelf life of this vaccine, most countries have about 4 months to have them distributed across their population, have not been able to use their supply necessarily across their whole population. And see, that's where you've only in recent time seen those kinds of arrangements. And that is really captured by the fact that New Zealand was the first country to use the EU template agreement for the purchase and supply of vaccines within the EU because it had not been, we had not had that template arrangement available to other countries prior to that point.
Buyer of vaccines be expected to raise an order for those vaccines before the 29th of January this year, given that other countries did so well earlier?
Mr. Speaker, again, the member completely misrepresents the process for purchasing vaccines. As I said, we began discussions with Pfizer in July of 2020. In August, we had a purchasing payment. In September, Pfizer presented to our research panel, and we made our first logistics call with the Ministry of Health. We signed an advance purchase agreement in October of 2020, before Pfizer even completed their phase three trial. Again, so many times in this House we've tried to correct the member. Mr. Speaker, I cannot help the member if she does not understand the process for the purchasing of pharmaceuticals in this country.
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Has the Prime Minister seen predictions that the inventory management system for the vaccine wouldn't be ready, the booking system would fail, that bookings were going to have to be cancelled because we were going to run out of vaccines, that we hadn't purchased enough syringes for vaccines, that we couldn't extract 7 doses out of a vial of vaccines, and that we didn't have enough vaccinators ready to deliver the vaccine? And did any of these predictions prove to be true?
Order, the member, the Prime Minister can answer one of those 9 questions.
Mr. Speaker, I have seen those claims say have proven not to be true. And at this point in our process, I wonder if it would be more helpful, rather than the member misrepresenting the process of purchasing Pfizer vaccines, actually get on board and continue to encourage, as I've seen signs the National Party have, continue to encourage people to be vaccinated.
Question number 3, David Seymour.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Prime Minister and reads as follows. Does she stand by her statement, quote, "We're in lockdown because we do not have enough New Zealanders currently vaccinated to stop an outbreak that would devastate our community," end quote?
Mr. Speaker, yes, and within the context of that interview, where my recollection is the claim was being made, why had we used a lockdown in this situation rather than alternative measures? But Mr. Speaker, I'd more generally say lockdown has been used the world over, in fact, less in New Zealand than many other countries, and have helped us achieve the lowest case rates, death rates and hospitalisations that we've seen in the OECD. But now we have vaccines that are safe and effective and that can help us change the way we've used public health restrictions, and we need to use that tool now we have it.
Can the Prime Minister name a country whose geographical isolation, population density, population age and wealth gave it a greater head start in battling a viral epidemic or pandemic than New Zealand?
Mr. Speaker, that actually squares with the answer I just gave. We've used those advantages to the best of our ability, and the team of 5 million has helped us not only return to pre-COVID levels in terms of economic growth, and you saw where our GDP stats were taking us, but also some of the lowest case rates, death rates and hospitalisations in the world. So I'm not sure which table the member is suggesting we should top out. We compared ourselves to ourselves and did what many others did not achieve.
Why didn't the Prime Minister add the government's response to that list of advantages I just gave?
Mr. Speaker, because it's implicit. We led the response all the way through. And Mr. Speaker, perhaps I noticed the member has stopped using the one country he did used to use, which was Taiwan, who I see has had to deal with extra outbreaks and is continuing to try and lift its vaccination rates.
Which country, if any, has high enough vaccination rates to stop an outbreak from, in her words, devastating their community?
Mr. Speaker, I think you'll see every country is trying to get their vaccination rates high enough that they can use a lower level of public health restrictions. I don't think I've seen anyone that is using nothing, though. Even Denmark, who many are referring to, does have very high vaccination rates across their total population, but is still using border controls. Businesses are still using what they call their corona pass. So I think you'd find very few places that are managing to keep hospitalisations low without using a coupling together of vaccinations and other measures, including their border measures.
If the Prime Minister can't name one country with a high enough vaccination rate to stop outbreaks that would, in her words, devastate their community, what strategy is this country relying on?
Mr. Speaker, the member is putting words in my mouth. It's only for those countries to determine whether or not their case rate is able to be managed in a way that they find acceptable to their community and to their health system. What I just gave you an example of, though, was a country that has managed to reduce down their public restrictions because they've had high rates. On the flip side, Singapore just has high vaccination rates, but they've continued to still use restrictions. Mr. Speaker, I think the thing that I would say to the member is we have always had the ability and the benefit of casting our eye around the world to see what other countries have done. And we very rarely simply replicated ourselves on others. We have designed our own strategy that is fit for purpose for our unique population, for our circumstances, and that meets our goals of keeping people safe and protecting their livelihoods and having as many personal freedoms as possible.
Will the vaccine rollout be complete when, as Chris Hipkins has clearly said, and she agreed, every New Zealander has had an opportunity to be vaccinated, or, as Ashley Bloomfield has said, when 90% of New Zealanders eligible are vaccinated?
Mr. Speaker, the member is incorrectly trying to portray there is a difference in opinion here. There is not. Both the Director General of Health and every minister that you will have heard us speak on this issue has pointed to us aspiring to have the highest vaccination rates in the world if we can, but certainly having as many eligible people as possible vaccinated. One of the concerns we've always had is if you set a rate too low, you immediately give the ability for someone just to opt to be a part of the percentage that is not vaccinated. We can't afford that. We've had roughly 40% of this outbreak has been those under 19 years of age. So a good portion have been children who cannot at this rate be vaccinated. They require all of those who can be to care for them.
If 89% of New Zealanders are vaccinated and everybody's had an opportunity, will the Prime Minister deem the vaccine rollout complete, even though we're not at 90? And will we be able to start taking steps to abandon the use of lockdowns and connect with the rest of the world?
Mr. Speaker, we actually presented our plans around reconnection several weeks ago, so I refer the member to that work rather than being repetitive on that. And you will have heard us say that we have plans to alter the way that we're working at our border in the first quarter of 2022, and that includes the self-isolation pilot that we're taking, establishing for the latter part of this year. On the question of whether or not we suddenly just close off the vaccine program, vaccines will need to continue to be available. I will never take away the ability for anyone at any point to change their mind and take up a vaccine. So long as there is any New Zealander who is not being vaccinated, vaccines will be available to them.
Was the number of vaccine doses administered yesterday down to only 50,000 from a peak of 90,000 a month ago due to supply or demand?
Mr. Speaker, demand. We have more than enough supply. Supply will no longer be an issue for the course of this vaccine rollout. And we have long signalled that October is the month when supply no longer becomes an issue. And with the additional doses that we managed to secure from Spain and Denmark, that certainly made that the case from September. Mr. Speaker, one thing I'll also point out is we do expect, of course, those numbers to move again once that big cohort we saw come through early on in the outbreak returned for second doses. In fact, today was the first day where second doses outnumbered first doses. Pleasingly, the uptake for second doses is at a very high rate, so we do anticipate being able to mirror that high first rate uptake with second. But it is going to take all of us. That last kind of 10% is going to be the bit that every country has seen takes that extra bit of effort.
Supplementary.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Did the Prime Minister see projections only 2 months ago that New Zealand would fail to achieve a vaccination rate of 50,000 doses per day, a rate that now some people are regarding as a failure?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I do recall when we said that our expectation was that we would hit a peak of 50,000 a day, being told that wouldn't be possible. Not only did we show it was possible, somehow now that is a sign of failure.
Why hasn't the Minister given a date by which she will be able to say every New Zealander has had the opportunity to be vaccinated?
Mr. Speaker, every New Zealander has an opportunity to be vaccinated now. As a member of a traditionary Liberal Party, I'd be surprised to suggest that a member seems to be suggesting that we should take away anyone's free will as they seek those vaccines. But that seems to be the suggestion from the member. Everyone has the opportunity today. There will be some who may have access issues, and we're actively reaching out, particularly to those who may be isolated or disabled, to even overcome those barriers. But everyone who wants one today can get one today. We have walk-in clinics, we have bookings. There is no question of capacity.
Question number four, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you. My question is to the Minister of Finance. Does he stand by his statement, quote, "Ministers have decided to use the greater fiscal headroom to top up the COVID-19 response and recovery fund by an extra $7 billion, end quote. If so, does that indicate that the COVID-19 response and recovery fund would not have been topped up had that fiscal headroom not been apparent?
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, in answer to the first part of the question, yes, and I stand by my full statement, quote, "The stronger economy has been reflected in the government's books, with lower deficits and debt position than had been predicted, and well below that of other nations that we compare ourselves against," end quote. "The extra funding will be targeted at further economic support, as well as building resilience in our health system, supporting the vaccination rollout and border and MIQ provision." In answer to the second part of the member's question, I know that he is fond of hypotheticals, but I don't get to deal in hypotheticals in this instance.
Does he accept that any perceived fiscal headroom arising from the previous quarter will have evaporated due to the protracted lockdown, and if not, why not?
Mr Speaker, I think the member underestimates the resilience of the New Zealand economy that we've seen over the course of the COVID outbreak. He'll recall that when we saw a significant drop in the June quarter of last year, we saw an even greater bounce back in the September quarter. I have faith in the New Zealand economy.
Does describing a massive spending and debt burden that might be ever so slightly massive meet his definition of fiscal headroom?
Mr Speaker, what the definition of fiscal headroom is that the government is overseen an economy that has produced more revenue in terms of tax, that has seen lower deficits and lower debt. That means that the government is in a strong position to support New Zealanders through this outbreak.
To the Minister, is using the May year-to-date projection of $6 billion less debt to justify $7 billion of extra spending an example of the government's fiscal discipline?
Mr Speaker, what it's an example of is the fact that the New Zealand economy, up until this outbreak, was performing extremely well. It was generating high levels of tax revenue, and it means that when we do come back out of this outbreak, I am very confident that the New Zealand economy will be resilient. I know the member doesn't want New Zealand to succeed, but on this side of the House, we do.
To the Minister, did he receive advice from Treasury on alternative approaches to making use of the so-called additional fiscal headroom? And if so, what was that advice?
Mr Speaker, I receive a steady stream of advice from number one, the terrorist, but we've been focused most recently on our response to the COVID outbreak.
To the Minister, how much of the $7 billion top-up would not have been needed if the government didn't spend as much as $12 billion of the previous $50 billion fund on items with tenuous or no link to COVID-19 response and recovery?
Mr Speaker, I completely reject the premise of the member's question. The COVID response and recovery fund has been spent on ensuring not only that we have the resources for the direct response in the health system or through the wage subsidy scheme, but also to support, for example, New Zealanders to stay and work. And we put out the budget in May 2020 where the first part of the $50 billion was allocated. We were facing down a 9% unemployment rate. Mr Speaker, New Zealand's unemployment rate peaked at just over 5% and has come down to 4%. That is a good outcome for New Zealanders. We have helped keep New Zealanders in work through the COVID fund.
Question number five, Jenny Anderson.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister for Police. What recent reports has the Minister seen regarding police's efforts to disrupt organised crime?
The Honourable Porter Williams.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. I've seen reports that police will continue to relentlessly target gangs and organised crime with the extension of the successful Operation Tōwhiro. Already as part of Operation Tōwhiro, police have seized 987 firearms, seized $4.99 million in cash, charged 865 people with firearms offences. Mr Speaker, this is a fantastic result. We have never been more active in cracking down on gangs and organised crime, and we'll get gang leaders off our streets. With the extension of Operation Tōwhiro, this government is continuing to take action to make sure New Zealanders and their families are kept safe. Well
done. How is the government continuing to support police's efforts to disrupt organised crime?
Thank you, Mr Speaker. This government has put a record number of police on the front line, including those with a specific focus on organised crime. And the result of this investment continues to pay off. In the last 4 years alone, police have seized $500 million in cash and assets from organised crime. We're also committed to introducing the firearms prohibition orders to protect the public from firearms harm and to hit gangs where it hurts their pockets by amending the Criminal Proceeds Recovery Act to give the police new powers to seize assets from organised criminals.
Question number six, Tiana Tuiono.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. Does she stand by her statement that we're acutely aware of the environmental risks associated with deep sea mining, and if so, why did New Zealand abstain on a motion supporting the protection of deep ocean ecosystems and biodiversity through a moratorium on seabed mining at the International Union for the Conservation of Nature last week?
Honourable Nanaia Mahuta.
Mr Speaker, yes I do. New Zealand is committed to the protection and preservation of the marine environment. We recognise that deep sea mining poses risks to the marine environment. New Zealand is one of the few countries to have a robust regulatory framework to govern seabed mining within its national jurisdiction. Internationally, we are actively engaged as a member of the International Seabed Authority in the development of a regulatory framework to govern seabed mining. We're calling for a robust legal framework, effective governance structures and high standards of environmental protection to ensure that deep sea mining does not take place unless we can ensure the protection of our oceans.
Supplementary. Does the Minister agree with MFAT's recent submission to the International Seabed Authority on its mining code, which states that a precautionary approach, quote, should be incorporated into the framework of regulations, standards and guidelines in a more considered, deliberate way? If so, why?
Yes, I do. And alongside that, as we advocate for the application of the precautionary approach for public participation in decision-making and for robust standards of environmental impact assessment and environmental monitoring and management plans, having a regulatory framework where there are set international rules and norms that sovereign nations can abide by when they consider deep-sea mining, it is a great guide to go by.
Why is the moratorium on seabed mining inconsistent with developing high standards of environmental protection then?
Mr Speaker, it's not a matter of whether a moratorium is inconsistent with high standards, it's a matter of what international rules and norms will guide countries as they make their sovereign decision around deep sea mining. That is why New Zealand continues to participate in the International Seabed Authority to develop the regulations that will guide these countries.
The Honourable Eugenie Sage.
Will New Zealand support an international moratorium on deep sea mining if development of the mining code at the International Seabed Authority fails to ensure the protection and preservation of the marine environment? If not, why not?
Thank you for the question. We are not at that stage yet. We would hope that by participating in the ISA to develop a strong regulatory framework where there are high environmental standards to guide sovereign nations on its consideration of deep sea mining, that that is the first port of call that we would go to. Any other consideration beyond that will have to be dealt with at that point in time.
Debbie Nawariwa-Packer.
Thank you. What will she say to tangata whenua in Aotearoa and tangata moana across the Pacific who have been consistently opposing this destructive mining of the seabed?
That New Zealand participates in a regime where we want a strong environmental framework to guide significant decisions such as seabed mining. In participating in the ISA and in establishing rules and norms that sovereign nations can abide by, we are in effect trying to achieve the same standard that we're applying on ourselves.
Supplementary. Does the Minister agree with the position expressed within the IUCN motion that there should be a moratorium until and unless, where relevant, the free, prior and informed consent of Indigenous peoples is respected and consent from potentially affected communities is achieved? If not, why not?
I'm aware of a number of views that have been expressed in relation to the views around the moratorium, but New Zealand's position remains the same. We participate in the ISA to ensure that there is a strong regulatory framework to guide sovereign nations in the way that it considers deep sea mining. That framework sets a very high environmental bar for those sovereign nations to be able to apply a mining code, and it would be the responsible approach as they are considering their deep sea mining opportunities.
In
abstaining on the motion at the ICN, is the Minister concerned that New Zealand's position on the deep sea mining motion is different from most other governments and government agencies at the IUCN, 81 of whom supported it? If not, why not?
Our position on the on that particular motion, alongside the UK, USA, Australia, Canada, France, was set to ensure that we could continue to work in a very strong way to build the regulatory framework through the ISA to guide countries in their determination, their sovereign determination of deep sea mining. It is a very high standard that we're trying to set and assure ourselves, and with multilateral countries who are of a common mind, they took the same position as New Zealand.
Question number 7, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for COVID-19 response, what percentage of the eligible population in New Zealand had received two doses of the COVID-19 vaccine as at 7 August 2021? And what modelling, if any, has he seen relating to how the level of vaccination coverage could affect the severity of COVID-19 restrictions?
The Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr. Speaker, as at the 7th of August 2021, 19% of those aged 12 and over had received two doses of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine. 33% had received at least their first dose. We've seen an extraordinary uptake of vaccination since everyone aged 12 and over became eligible to book a vaccine. To date, more than 4,762,000 doses have been administered. Approximately 39% of the eligible population are now fully vaccinated, and approximately 74% have received their first dose. I've received a range of advice that emphasises the importance of widespread vaccination in preventing the spread of COVID-19, which in turn reduces the need for restrictions. That's why right now we're encouraging all New Zealanders to come forward and be vaccinated.
Why did New Zealand only have 19% of the eligible population of the 12-plus population with double vaccination at the 7th of August?
Mr. Speaker, a range of factors, but the most notable, of course, was supply.
Has he seen any modelling or advice from officials indicating that if New Zealand had even 50% vaccination coverage in August, as opposed to what happened, which was less than 20%, the most recent lockdown could have been shorter and more regional?
Mr. Speaker, no, not necessarily. One of the things that we need to think about when we're talking about vaccination rates is actually a focus on the unvaccinated population and the characteristics of the unvaccinated population. What we've seen from around the world is that COVID-19 hunts out those parts of the community that are unvaccinated. They tend to be lower socioeconomic areas. They tend to be people who have who are more susceptible to COVID-19 and an adverse health outcome from that. So setting an arbitrary target, for example, around vaccination isn't actually the ultimate answer here. We want to get everybody vaccinated.
So is he saying, firstly, that he hasn't seen, or secondly, that he doesn't agree with the paper from Sean Hendy on the 30th of June that shows that a 50% vaccination rate compared to a 30% vaccination rate halves the length of time lockdowns are required for?
Well, Mr. Speaker, again, the member didn't listen to the last answer that I gave. Yes, I've seen a whole variety of different models, but let's talk about this current outbreak. This current outbreak is disproportionately skewed to young people, a significant proportion of whom are not currently eligible for the vaccine.
Does he agree with the Prime Minister's comments from February in relation to the vaccine rollout that, quote, we're not in a race to be first? And does he now accept that if we hadn't been the slowest in the OECD for most of this year, we'd be in a better position now?
Mr. Speaker, no. I utterly reject the assertion in the member's question, along with all of the other assertions that he has made, like we were going to run out of vaccines, we didn't have enough syringes, we didn't have enough vaccinators, the booking system was going to fail, that we weren't going to be able to deliver 50,000 vaccines a day. Instead of undermining the vaccine campaign, perhaps he should get behind it.
Does he agree with the Prime Minister and other ministers who have said words to the effect of, it doesn't matter how fast our vaccine rollout is because other countries need it more? And does he think that the Aucklanders who are now enduring the longest lockdown in New Zealand history might be reflecting negatively on those comments?
What I do agree with, Mr. Speaker, is that the member should stop spreading misinformation. That is not what any minister in this government has said. I would say to any New Zealander listening to him that they should think twice about any of the statements he makes because most of them don't stack up.
Question number 8, Ibrahim Omar.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister for Research, Science and Innovation and asks, what recent announcement has she made that will help New Zealanders' COVID-19 response and preparedness for future pandemics?
The Honourable Aisha Vero.
Mr. Speaker, on Sunday I was pleased to announce that the government is investing in a new infectious diseases research platform. New Zealand's response to COVID-19 has been informed by science from the beginning, and as a result we have saved lives. But the lack of a dedicated infectious diseases research fund has been a long-standing gap in our domestic science capabilities. When the pandemic hit, scientists either volunteered time to support the COVID-19 response or received ad hoc grants for small pieces of research. To address this, we are investing $36 million over 3 years in a new program of research to sustain the contribution of cutting-edge scientists to the COVID-19 response.
Supplementary. What will the major research focus be?
Mr. Speaker, the first priority area is improving prevention and control, including through better understanding of disease transmission and future vaccine research. The second is improving our management of infectious diseases, for instance through diagnostics, surveillance and therapeutics. Reducing the impact of infectious diseases on Māori and Pacific people will also be a key focus. That work can only be done here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. I also see this research platform as promoting the development of our next generation of pandemic scientists. This work will not just help with our current response to COVID-19, but also help prevent future pandemics.
Supplementary. What reaction has she seen to the announcement of the infectious disease research platform?
Mr. Speaker, I've been heartened by the positive reception of local experts. Andrim Basu, Associate Professor of Epidemiology and Environmental Health at the University of Canterbury, described the announcement as an excellent and welcome move, saying additional infectious diseases research funding focused on COVID-19 will be immensely beneficial to everyone. Epidemiologist Dr. Amanda Kalsvig from the Department of Public Health, University of Otago, Wellington, also welcomed the announcement, saying it has the potential to make a huge difference to the lives of New Zealanders. And immunologist Professor Graham Legros, Director of the Maligan Institute of Medical Research and Program Director of the Vaccine Alliance Aotearoa New Zealand, said this is very good news and a much needed investment in the skill set and technologies that will be needed to protect New Zealand against the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic.
Question number 9, Dr. James McDowell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Immigration. What communications, if any, has he received from Afghan translators who live in New Zealand about bringing their families to New Zealand, and what actions is he taking as a result?
The Honourable Chris Farfoy.
Mr. Speaker, I have received a number of communications from Afghan translators who live in New Zealand, setting out their concern for their community and their family members who remain in Afghanistan. Understandably, these concerns have heightened as a result of the fall of the Afghan government. Many of them are seeking pathways for their family members to join them here in New Zealand. Since the emergency evacuation window for getting people out of Afghanistan closed, they've also turned to what more New Zealand can do to assist in the plight of people still in Afghanistan, and our focus remains very much on those who are included in Cabinet's criteria. Immigration New Zealand is working alongside INFAT and the New Zealand Defence Force, who in turn are discussing with international partners how to help others leave Afghanistan. Consideration is also being given to short and longer term settlement support services for the individuals who have recently arrived. We know the situation in Afghanistan is volatile, and I'm expecting advice from officials on what additional support New Zealand can offer shortly.
Supplementary. Has he met with the Afghan translators waiting outside Parliament for him? And if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, I don't meet all the groups that come to Parliament to make their point. What I would say is that the letters that they have sent me have been received, certainly the ones in the last 24 hours, and their message has been heard. The priority of the government, as I said in my primary answer, is to assist people who were very much in a similar situation to them when they were allowed to come to New Zealand, those who assisted agencies in Afghanistan and their immediate families. It has been a very challenging situation to evacuate all of those people back, as well as New Zealand citizens and residents. As I've said, we are currently looking at what other options we can to make sure we can assist those who are also looking to leave Afghanistan.
Metri. How was the Minister able to spend 10 minutes sitting in the debating chamber before question time today joking with other MPs while the Afghan translators continue to wait for him outside?
Order, order, order. A point of order, David Seymour.
Mr. Speaker, the Minister has said that his time does not allow him to meet. I think that is the question from the member is perfectly in order and reasonable.
Well, the member might be of that view, but what we do not do in this House is question members as to their movements around the buildings on the way to and in the chamber before question time. It's been a long-standing convention of the House.
Can the Minister guarantee that action will be taken to expedite the visas of translators' relatives, and if so, when?
Mr. Speaker, I'll point the member to my earlier answer that the government is focused on making sure that we can get New Zealand residents and citizens who are in Afghanistan home, and also those who are within the strict cabinet criteria while the evacuation window was open. We're also considering what other options we might be able to take in order to assist other people who would like to leave Afghanistan. Those decisions have not yet been made.
Supplementary. Does the Minister understand that relatives of Afghan translators who helped Kiwi soldiers are under constant threat of persecution by the Taliban, and what will he do to uphold the principles of kindness this government has set itself?
Mr. Speaker, the government takes very seriously its values of kindness, which is why we're making sure that we take a very measured approach to the assistance that we offer those people that we have prioritised. One of those things that we have to make sure that we do, as I've said both to select committees and publicly, is that we have to make sure we have the ability to resettle these people who might come from Afghanistan in a first-class way. We're working through some of those issues, and we hope to be able to do that to make sure we can help the plight of some of those people still in Afghanistan.
Question number 10, Barbara Edmund.
To the Minister for Women, what support is the government providing for women and girls adversely affected by COVID-19?
The Honourable Jan Tinetti.
Mr. Speaker, as the Minister for Women, I have announced a $2 million community fund to support vulnerable women and girls adversely affected by COVID-19. We know from the last nationwide lockdown that women experience disproportionately adverse effects, including job losses, loss of income, increased unpaid care work, and additional barriers to those seeking to leave violent and abusive situations. This government has acted quickly to ensure we take rapid and effective action to reach women during the current lockdown and safeguard their well-being.
Supplementary. Why is this type of community fund needed?
Mr. Speaker, last nationwide lockdown we established the same fund, which allocates funding through established community groups and organisations at grassroots level. All evaluations found that this is a highly effective way to reach vulnerable women, as there is an existing relationship with this cohort. The fund supported 155 organisations and over 10,000 women and their families. While there are other government supports available to vulnerable New Zealanders, including women, through schemes such as the wage subsidy, we know there are additional gender-based needs. Examples include help with leaving an abusive partner, culturally appropriate support networks for migrant women, mental health support for rainbow women, and a lack of access to basic toiletries.
Supplementary. How will the $2 million be allocated to community providers?
The funding is to support organisations who, one, work to improve outcomes for women and girls, and two, are seeking an increased demand for services and or reduced resources because of COVID-19. The three objectives of the fund are to prioritise grassroots investments, making sure funds are spent to improve outcomes for women and where they are needed most, support women in all their diversity who face intersectional challenges within their communities, such as women in Māori, Pacific, rural and migrant communities, and supporting the government's priorities, such as ensuring healthy and safe communities, reducing family and sexual violence, and improving child wellbeing. Each organisation can apply for up to $50,000 of funding, and applications are currently open until the 1st of October, and organisations can apply on the Ministry for Women's website.
Question number 11, the Honourable Scott Simpson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Corrections. Is he confident that the Department of Corrections policies are keeping New Zealanders safe from COVID-19? If so, why?
The Honourable Kevin Davis.
Mr. Speaker, yes. As we saw in this recent case, it was Corrections health screening that helped us to identify that there was potential that COVID had spread in the community. While Corrections have strict policies in place to stop the spread of COVID in prisons, this case has identified that there are areas where we can look to create improvements around transportation. While these are outside of the control of Corrections, given bail conditions are set by the courts, I have asked my officials to work with other agencies to see what improvements can be made around transportation. This approach was outlined by the Prime Minister earlier today. I'm confident in Corrections processes to minimise risks relating to the transmission of COVID-19, though. These include health screening for every person who enters a prison. All prison staff are required to wear masks at all times while on site. And when staff are interacting with prisoners, they are wearing personal protective equipment to prevent transmission. The secure and controlled nature of the prison environment means Corrections are able to quickly isolate prisoners as required, restrict their movements and identify people who would have been in contact with them if required.
As Corrections Minister, does he think it's fair that essential workers should be required to show that they have had a COVID-19 test before travelling through an alert level boundary, but Black Power member recently released from prison should not be required to?
Well, Mr. Speaker, again, this is an issue around the transportation of prisoners. Corrections doesn't set those conditions. The judges and the courts set the bail conditions. So he needs to really address his question to the correct minister.
As Corrections Minister, does he place more trust in prisoners who are being released from prison to travel through an alert level boundary without being tested for COVID-19 than essential workers?
Order. Yeah. Order. Order. The Minister doesn't have responsibility for either of those groups.
Mr. Speaker, I was asking whether he thought it was fair or did he have trust? Yeah, my question was, does he have placed trust?
Well, prisoners, people have been released from prison and essential workers, neither of those groups are the responsibility of this Minister.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker. The prisoner is still in the care of corrections staff, still in the purview of the corrections department.
No, the member said the person had been released from prison. Not that.
It's exactly what the member said.
Point of order, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Mr. Speaker, we
into a tangle between the whether the question is in order or whether the answer should have been given in that way by the Minister. I'm suggesting to you that while that may well have been the answer the Minister could have given, that doesn't render the question out of order.
Mr. Speaker, the Minister of Corrections is responsible for people who are in prison. The judges and the courts set the bail conditions. The Minister of Corrections is not responsible for that.
David Seymour.
In case I can assist, Mr. Speaker, they may have...
You're always here to help.
That's me. he may well have been released from prison, but he was still in the care of corrections, and surely the Minister's perception of and the Minister's attitude towards the behaviour of prisoners and their trustworthiness while under the care of corrections is something that is very relevant that this House is allowed to ask about. That's what the question was about. Does the Minister trust those prisoners who are under corrections care? His attitude towards prisoners is of great interest to this House.
Yeah, and if the question had been asked like that, it would have been in order. I'm prepared to be generous and let the member rephrase his question so he makes it clear there's ministerial responsibility. I am being very kind. Oh, Mr. Bridges. Is the member trying to fly? Or I've heard him described as Samson recently, but... that's right, Samson. Yes.
Mr. Speaker, as the Minister of Corrections, does he place more trust in persons who are in the care of corrections staff recently released from prison to travel through an alert level boundary without being tested for COVID-19 than essential workers?
Mr. Speaker, I trust the corrections processes.
Mr. Speaker, to the Minister, what specific measures, if any, did the Department of Corrections take to ensure the transportation of the prisoner to Northern Hauraki would be done safely and appropriately, given Auckland's lockdown status and in light of corrections deeming him unsuitable for bail?
Mr. Speaker, I'll refer to my primary answer. The case has identified that there are areas where we can look to create improvements around transportation. While these areas are outside of the control of corrections, given bail conditions are set by courts, including the transport of prisoners, I've asked my officials to work with other agencies to see what improvements can be made around transportation.
At what point did the Department of Corrections realise the prisoner had stopped at four different locations, including two private addresses, and why wasn't he arrested for breach of bail when his bail conditions required him to travel without any unnecessary stops?
So, Mr. Speaker, Corrections and Police jointly manage electronically monitored bail. Corrections assesses a person and their proposed address for electronic EM bail suitability and carries out the electronic monitoring. Police are responsible for responding to all non-compliance and managing any other bail conditions imposed by the courts. Corrections has no involvement in non-EM bail though.
Why did corrections staff allow the prisoner to be picked up by three individuals when his bail condition stated that a specified family member was to collect him from Mount Eden Corrections Facility? And does this demonstrate a complete failure by corrections to monitor the prisoner effectively, given they had concerns about him being unsuitable for bail?
Mr. Speaker, no.
That concludes oral questions. I call on... Angela Roberts, number 12. I apologise.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Minister of Conservation. What recent announcements has she made regarding Jobs for Nature projects in Otago and Southland?
The Honourable Kiritapu, Alan, I doubly apologise.
Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, as part of our COVID recovery on the 16th of September, I announced a package of 9 Jobs for Nature projects across Otago and Southland. The projects represent an investment of more than $17 million into nature
and the community, and are collectively expected to create more than 200 jobs through protecting threatened species, making a well-known lake swimmable, and supporting areas hit by the downturn in international tourism.
Supplementary. What projects will be delivered in the Queenstown Lakes District?
Mr. Speaker, as we all know, the Queenstown Lakes District has been impacted by the downturn in international tourism as a result of COVID. And a key focus of Jobs for Nature is providing investments into these communities. $4.45 million is being provided to a project to rehabilitate Arrowtown's Lake Hayes, which aims to make the lake swimmable again by working with community groups to undertake native planting, wetland restoration, predator control and installation of sediment traps. $2.98 million has been provided to the Southern Lake Sentry Project, assisting more than 80 local predator control initiatives across 150,000 hectares of the Southern Lakes region to protect 23 threatened and at-risk wildlife species from invasive species.
And what projects will be delivered in Fiordland?
Mr. Speaker, more good news. A range of projects in Fiordland are receiving funding, coming at an important time for another beautiful region for which international tourism is a key part of their local economy. These include bringing the park to the people through trail enhancement, $973,000 for the Fiordland Trails Trust to protect threatened bird species. Tamatea Restoration has received $700,000 for the Pure Salt Cruisers to develop and use new technologies to eliminate predators within the Tamatea Dusky Sound region. The Rootburn Dart Wildlife Trust Predator Trapping Project has received $4,116 for additional predator control in the Rootburn Dart and nearby valleys. And Mr. Speaker, the Big Bay Awarua Ecosystem Restoration has received $383,000 to establish a trapping network at Big Bay Awarua and Waiuna Lagoon to help protect vulnerable native birds such as fern birds, bittern, rail and kaka.
That concludes our questions.